He grew up in New Rochelle, New York, son of the famous actor and writer Carl Reiner. In the 1970s, he became one of the best and most recognizable actors on primetime TV as a co-star on Norman Lear's iconic American TV show, one of the most consequential of all time, All in the Family. Following his career as an actor, Rob Reiner went on to a career as a movie director through the company he founded, Castle Rock Entertainment, directing such movies as When Harry Met Sally and one of my favorites, A Few Good Men. He is the recipient of numerous Emmys and other awards for his career in show business. Among his many activities today, I think it is fair to say, and I don't think he would mind me saying, he is a political activist for various progressive causes. Rob, thank you for joining us on WBGO, and thank you for your time.
Jay, thank you for having me.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days.
Rob Reiner, let me start with this. I want to ask you about All in the Family. All in the Family is probably one or two or three of my favorite TV shows. I still watch the reruns. I've seen every episode through the 1970s. I recall vividly my family. We would all sit around the TV on Saturday nights. All in the Family was on at 8 o'clock. There was always some sitcom in there at 8:30 that got switched out. And then there was Mary Tyler Moore, and then there was Bob Newhart. Interestingly, my father, who grew up in the Jim Crow South, didn't really care for the All in the Family brand of humor, but was a huge fan of Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart. But I was, and I had numerous members of my extended family who thought All in the Family was incredibly funny. And it was a groundbreaking show because up until then, half-hour sitcoms are all, feel-good shows, where they make you feel good, Leave It to Beaver and so forth. By the way, I noticed in your Wikipedia you were on the Andy Griffith Show and the
Yes.
Partridge Family. I must have missed that. It must have been a very short appearance. But All in the Family was groundbreaking. Archie regularly used the N-word in his vocabulary. And I want to ask you, what was Norman Lear's theory behind, and this is, we're now talking 1970, 1971. What was his theory behind presenting bigotry on primetime TV in a manner that we could laugh at?
Yeah, well, Norman Lear, he always talked about how his favorite play of all time was Major Barbara by George Bernard Shaw. And if you know the play or you know about it, Shaw was a liberal. But if you went to see that play, you would not know that Shaw was a liberal. You would, he presented the hawk point of view and the dove point of view equally. The idea was that you watch this play, you leave it, and then you discuss what you saw. He would present both sides equally. He wanted to do that with All in the Family. He wanted to present Archie, the right-wing conservative bigot, and Mike, the character I played, the liberal, the political liberal. And the two of them would go at each other about whatever the issues of the day. We dealt with race, with the Vietnam War, with the women's movement, with sexuality, all of these things. And the idea was to get people talking about it, just to, open the conversation. And I've said this many times, but All in the Family was on at a time when the country was, there were two, maybe 200 million the most in the country. And if you wanted to watch the show, you had to watch it when it was on. There was no DVR, no TiVo, you couldn't videotape it. So every week we had 40 to 45 million people sitting and having a shared experience, like you talked about with your family. Your father maybe didn't like it, but you got into it. And so you're all sitting there having this shared experience. Then you go to work over the weekend, noon, the next Monday, and you're talking about it. You're talking about whatever issues we dealt with on that show. Now you've got a country of 330, 335 million. And if you have a hit television show, you're maybe getting 10 to 15 million people, and they're not all watching it at the same time. They're all watching. They've got it on streamers. They've got it, tape, whatever. And so you don't have that shared experience where you can discuss it. And that was Norman Lear's idea, is to put these ideas out there and spark the dialogue.
The two funniest moments to this day, I believe, that I've ever seen on TV were, first of all, the Sammy Davis Jr. episode, where Archie says to Edith, listen, when he gets here, you'll see one of his eyes is glass, but don't say anything about it. And then, he's sitting down, he's serving him coffee, and he says, Mr. Davis, do you want sugar in your eye?
Yeah, take cream and sugar in your eye.
I said, Sammy Davis Jr. is maybe the greatest credit to his race.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure you've done good for yours, too.
I try. Mr. Davis, do you take cream and sugar in your eye?
The other very, very funny moment, in my opinion, was the episode Trapped in the Cellar.
Yes.
Where he thinks Archie's trapped in the cellar. He's drunk. He's had too much to drink. He thinks he's going to freeze to death. And he says, Lord, come and get me. And all of a sudden he hears a knock at the front door and this deep baritone voice, who turns out to be the oil man coming to fix the heater, comes in, descends down the stairs. Archie gets down on his knees, expecting to meet the Lord Almighty face to face. And it's a black man with a beard who's looking very holy with the scarf. And Archie gets down on his knees because he realizes he's seeing the Lord. He says, forgive me, Lord. The Jeffersons was right. That to me, that was
the Jeffersons
totally hysterical.
Hold up, Mr. Parker.
All right, I'm waiting for you.
Mr. Parker.
The Jeffersons was right.
The other one that got me was, one day there was one episode where my character was under a lot of stress. There was finals in school and I was having a hard time, making love to Gloria. I couldn't.
I just saw that episode the other night.
And he runs into Jefferson at the bar and he says, listen, you people, you're good at you know a lot about this stuff. My son, he's stuck in neutral. What's your advice? He asked the black guy for advice on sex.
So let me ask you about the Michael Stivic character. When I was watching it primetime in the 70s, as a young man, I was always on the assumption that Archie was always wrong and Mike was always right. Michael Stivic was more educated. He was more intelligent, more thoughtful. In later years, when I look at these episodes now, I tell me whether you agree or disagree with this. I see a certain instances of a little bit of hypocrisy in Mike. And it's a little bit forced, too stereotypical. Like every once in a while, Michael would expose himself as having some rather sexist attitudes to Gloria.
He was sick. There was no question that Michael, my character, was sexist. He always viewed, he was a misogynist. I mean, he might have had liberal attitudes about guns, about race, about the Vietnam War, whatever. But when it came to men and women, he was not woke, as they say. But what was interesting, you told me that you just said that, when you watched the show, you always thought Mike was right, because probably you agreed with him more politically. But the country was divided, has been divided, is still very divided. And a big swath of the country agreed with Archie. And that's what made the show interesting. I always thought, how could you agree with a guy who was a bigot like that? But, there's a lot of people in this country, and we know that this country is divided along those political lines, and that's the way it was, and it is still.
The most powerful moment in All in the Family, in my opinion, was the Draft Dodger episode. And Michael invites a friend of his, who turns out to be a draft dodger who's living in Canada, to sit down for dinner at the family dinner table. And nobody was going to tell Archie. You're going to keep it from him because you knew if you told him, he'd go ballistic. And it came out in the conversation. And Michael confront Archie about the Vietnam War. And he said something that I thought was very revealing and powerful. He said, "I'm not talking about that damn war anymore. I'm talking about something else." He's talking about the draft. And to me, it was significant because it was a sort of spontaneous admission by Archie, a recognition that the Vietnam War was wrong.
Yeah.
Where traditionally you would expect Archie to kind of hew to the company line.
Yeah. He might have at that point, because we're talking about, you know, this is the early 70s and the war was, you know, they were trying to get out. By 72, 73, I mean, it was clear we had lost and we were had to leave. And maybe he was sick and tired of the fact that there had been so many protests and there had been such pushback on the war and we were losing, that it was more about supporting your country. You know, if you were drafted, you got to go and fight. You have to support your country. And of course, you know, the position that Mike had and young people at the time was, yeah, we support our country, but not when it's wrong. You know, it's not my country, right or wrong. It's if you think it's wrong, that's the beauty of America. You can protest and say what you think is wrong about it in order to right it. And I think over the years, many of the protests and the people marching, and I was certainly included in that, eventually helped stop the war. And I think, unfortunately, it was such a divisive time, and like I say, still is, that I felt bad later on, many years later, I felt bad that people who had to go and fight in that war, people, you know, who lost their lives, that when they came back, they were not treated well. Vietnam veterans were not treated well. They were looked down upon. And it's only over time that I realized, they're just people, you know, and they're trying to do what they think is right. They're serving their country, whatever. And even if it's a bad cause, it's like, you know, there was no, but you still have to support the Americans, and you still have to support them and make sure that they have good health care when they get back. And a lot of people have PTSD, and you got to make sure that, Veterans Administration is doing what they need to be doing. So, you know, as you get older, you do, you know, your views change as you get older.
Speaking of that, over the seasons, the Archie Bunker character definitely mellowed. What do you think was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think what we showed is all the characters changed over time, because if you look at Edith's character, she became much more of a feminist as the women's movement heated up during the 70s. She became more aware of the feminist position. Archie did soften. There's a wonderful, and you know, you were talking about Stuck in the Cellar. There was a show where Archie and I were trapped in the cellar together. And we were, you know, bearing our souls to each other. And he basically told me that he loved me. And I told him that I loved him. I mean, so even though we were on opposite sides of all these issues, as human beings, we could come together and show our feelings for each other. Unfortunately, politically, we're in a weird place now. You don't see any of that now.
Well, I remember that episode. And I remember that Archie basically acknowledged to Michael that he was beaten as a child,
right,
and made fun of as a child. And I remember Michael felt very sorry for him in that moment when he fell asleep after drinking too much.
Right.
The Michael Stivic character also evolved over time. So, you know, looking at his character as a rap, how would you characterize Michael?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, if we were to track him today, he would probably be, the misogyny doesn't completely ever go away, because if you're raised in a certain way where the woman's place is in the home and the man brings home the bacon and the roles are defined that way, it never goes away completely. But you certainly can start to understand as time goes by how important it is that everybody be treated equally, that women have a chance, the same chance as men have, that they should get the same pay that men get. And I think that he would have evolved that way had he had we seen his progression over time. But certainly, you know, not in the time of the show. I think he might have ultimately progressed on that front.
Right. Rob, I want to turn to your career as a director. You retired from acting. You went into directing of films. Let me ask you a dumb question to begin, which I've never understood the answer to. And now I have a director. What is the fundamental difference between a producer, a writer, and a director of movies?
Okay, well, since the 50s and 60s, when the director became, it used to be where the director was a gun for hire. And in many cases in television, that is the case. In filmmaking, it became more of an auteur kind of thing, where the director became essentially the author of the whole film. In some cases, he was the writer of the screenplay. But in cases where he wasn't the writer of the screenplay, he might have worked on the screenplay, but maybe didn't have credit, he would be responsible for all the creative decisions made in the film. Who was cast in which parts, how the script would play out. He would find the director of photography. He would work with the editor in editing the film. He would do everything that you saw on screen. He would be the ultimate creative decision maker. The producer is usually the guy who either develops a project or finds the money to make a project. And the writer is, to me, the most important. He's the one who's writing the story. He's writing the screenplay. Many times that writer is working with the director. I've worked every single film I've done. I've worked very closely with the writer so that the ultimate screenplay that we have is a reflection of what I want to say with a film. But essentially, the director in today's parlance is the creative arbiter of everything you see on the screen.
So A Few Good Men, you were the director. Does that mean you also had a role in the content?
Well, yes, and in that one, not so much as in others, because A Few Good Men was based on a play that was on Broadway that Aaron Sorkin wrote. And so the film is very much a reflection of what is in the play. Although in working with Aaron, and one of the partners at Castle Rock, Andy Scheinman, we plugged up some of the holes that existed, that we felt existed in the play, and we added them to the screenplay, particularly the famous scene where Jack Nicholson says, "You can't handle the truth."
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
In the play, there was nothing that would trigger Colonel Jessup to all of a sudden start spilling his guts and, you know, come out and say, basically, "I ordered the code red." We felt that a guy as smart as Jessup would have to be motivated in some way to say what he had to say. So we came up with this idea of these two airmen that were going to be sitting in the courtroom that we said had something to do with their knowledge of what happened at Andrews Air Force Base when supposedly Santiago was sent out of Cuba to D.C. Now, you can see Tom Cruise playing Caffey very nervous during that because they don't arrive right away. And he realizes, oh, my God, I've got this one thing I'm going to do to try to get Jessup to tell us what he knows.
Trapped him.
They trap him. And once those guys arrive, he knows he has them. And he says, "Well, we'll talk about the logbook later." He basically is laying a trap. So when Jessup sees those two guys come in, he goes, "Uh-oh, these guys are going to be able to testify that there was no flight. to Andrews, and that it didn't exist, and that they were planning to kill this guy and not send him. But as it turns out, it was just a trap, because those two guys didn't know anything about it. He just wanted him to sit there. So it was a clever thing that we did that was not in the play, that we added to the screenplay, and a few other things like that.
I've actually used that cross-examination in educational PowerPoints that I give as a trial lawyer and a lawyer to others to say, look, in your career, it's never going to get this good. You're never going to trap a witness into confessing the crime. But what was interesting to me, first of all, the courtroom scenes and the courtroom, the site of the courtroom is actually on the campus of what is today the Department of Homeland Security. You and I have discussed that. And the courtroom, I mean, you rarely, if ever in a career, get a witness to confess a crime like that on cross-examination. But the dialogue, the transcript dialogue was very real. It was very, the actual dialogue was very lawyerly. So a lawyer must have had a hand in that script.
Well, Aaron Sorkin's sister was in the JAG Corps. She was a military lawyer. And the case that this is based on was a case that she tried. There were actually more than two witnesses. I mean, and there was more than the one guy died. And there were 10, I think there were 10, 10 people on trial. I can't remember. But anyway, it was based on Aaron's sister's case. So, yes, I mean, you know, and he comes from a family of lawyers. He's the only one, I think, in the family that's not a lawyer. But here's the one thing I want to tell you, a funny story about this. So, you know, we had a years ago, there was a Billy Crystal was being honored for the Mark Twain Prize. And they had a reception for him at the Supreme Court that was being hosted by Anthony Kennedy, who was one of the justices at the time. And there was a little, before we sat down for dinner, during the cocktail portion, he comes up to me and he says, you know, these courtroom dramas, they're not very good. I don't think they're very good. They're not really, I don't really like them that much. But I got to say, A Few Good Men, that was really, really good. And he says, that and My Cousin Vinny was the other one. And I thought, okay, you know, everybody's got a view. Okay, I got that and I got that. So it put me in my place right away.
Well, actually, my favorite line in the movie is, of course, the Jack Nicholson exchange. But there was also a moment where Jack Nicholson gets up from the witness stand. He starts to walk out. Tom Cruise says, I'm not done with you yet. I haven't excused you. And he says, you know, refer to me as Colonel. And then he looks at the judge, who's a Marine colonel like the witness.
Right.
And says, what kind of outfit you're running here? And the judge, who was black, looked at him and said, and you'll refer to me as Your Honor or Sir. I'm quite sure I've earned that.
I'm quite sure I've earned it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That was a great line. But the interesting thing to me, coming from a career in both law and national security, is, and the movie was made in 1992, pre-9/11. Nicholson said, you want me on that wall, you need me on that wall. I have neither the time or inclination to answer to a man who rises and sleeps under the blanket of security I provide and then questions the manner in which I provide it.
Wow, I can't believe that you know that. And I'm going to tell the listeners that Jay is not reading this off a page. He's actually reciting this.
Well, the reason I know that line is because, I mean, it's not so much a courtroom admission. It actually gives voice to how a lot of people in national security actually feel. I mean, I don't agree with the sentiment expressed, but I know there are a lot of people in national security who feel I keep you safe. You go about your daily life. I'm keeping you safe. How dare you question the manner in which I keep you safe?
Right.
And, you know, that manifests itself post 9/11 with some of the enhanced interrogation techniques
right.
And the like. But the line was remarkable, in my judgment, for that sort of accuracy of sentiment.
Right. And I think, you know, Jack Nicholson told me, because, you know, he is, you know, he said that's what allowed him to play the part, because he does believe, you know, you don't want to go to the extremes of, like you say, torture, you know, torture techniques and things like that. But he believes that, you know, that that's their job, is to protect.
On that note, Rob Reiner, thank you very much for joining us on WBGO. Thank you for your time. And thank you for all the things you have done for America.
Thank you so much, Jay. It was a pleasure.